It's the camels that command the most attention. Young men haul them before prospective buyers, pulling with all their might on the rope fastened to the camel's lower jaw.
From this market in Nigeria, to a robot exhibit in Shanghai, to a meal at a roadside stand in Jamaica, we're taking you on a vacation getaway on this week's World Vision Report.
Well, we always have this for breakfast, especially on a Sunday morning, and a cup of chocolate, Jamaican chocolate, the one that you buy in the market, and you grate it, and you boil it with cinnamon and coconut cream.
And we'll stop in Nepal, where a street vendor sells a hand-carved musical instrument that sounds like a voice.
What is this called?
Their name is sarangi.
Sarangi?
Sarangi.
Can you play for me?
Okay.
Come along with us on this week's World Vision Report Getaway Special. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. So you were thinking of getting away for a little vacation this year. I know, it sounded like such a good idea. But your bills are teetering in a pile, your car's brakes are making that awful squeaking sound, and those two woefully short vacation weeks you get from work, they're already used up. Don't despair. We're going to take you around the world with us. And you won't even have to stuff yourself into a plane seat that's too small, or a bathing suit that's too small. First, we're taking you to Nepal. It may be dwarfed by its huge neighbors, China and India, but it has 8 of the world's 10 highest mountains. Right now, it's monsoon season there. That might not bother you, but it's not good for the street vendors in the capital, Kathmandu. They don't really mind as long as the tourism season was strong before the rains came. But remember that volcanic ash over Europe? Add to that the strikes that shut Kathmandu down in May, and you get a year of lousy tourism. Reporter Shannon Mullen introduces us to a street vendor there who's feeling the pinch.
In the high season, the narrow streets of Tamil, Kathmandu's shopping district, are cramped and chaotic. Street vendors make their living here by hawking plaster Buddhas, prayer flags, and pashminas. But from June through September, these streets are mostly empty, except for other vendors.
Because now it's go off-season, yeah?
Off-season. Jilke Gandharva supports his wife and 4 kids by selling a hand-carved wooden musical instrument. What is this called?
Their name is sarangi.
Sarangi?
Sarangi.
Can you play for me?
Okay.
The sarangi looks like a small rudimentary fiddle, and Nepalis say it sounds like the human voice. Gandharva's has a bird carved into its neck and the head of an elephant at the other end. He plays from memory, his bow moving like an extension of his hand. Mid-song, Gandharva looks at peace, unless a rare potential customer passes by. Then his bright eyes narrow as he switches from performance to survival mode. This past spring, Gandharva says he made a fraction of his usual sales, thanks to the Icelandic volcano and the political unrest here. Working through the off-season, he adds, won't make up for the loss.
How many do you sell per day?
So some days selling just 2-3 pieces. Some time is 1 week, 2 week, not business.
No sales. For weeks.
Yes.
Gandharva buys sarangis from local craftsmen for about $20 a piece. Then, depending on tourist traffic, he marks his price up, anywhere from 200% in boom time to just 20% in tough times like this. Gandharva says when people do buy his instruments, they often see them as souvenirs and plan to just hang them on their walls. But once in a while, he meets a tourist who loves the sarangi for its music. And for a few extra rupees, he'll teach them how to play. For the World Vision Report, I'm Shannon Mullen in Kathmandu, Nepal.
Our next stop, the coastal city of Shanghai, where the Yangtze River empties into the sea. This lively city has become home to the world's biggest cargo port. But we're going to avoid those crowds and slip into an art exhibit instead. This one should amuse you. Rebecca Canther reports.
Picture this, a giant robot made of scrap metal with ping pong balls for eyes and a straw hat upon its head lurches loudly across the room, pulling a rickshaw behind him. It's a sight that's been captivating visitors to an exhibit here at the Rockbund Art Museum. I'm taking my dad to go shopping, the robot calls out. The robot's dad is 48-year-old Uyu Lu, a farmer turned inventor from a village outside Beijing. With only a primary school education, Wu has been tinkering with gadgets ever since he was a teenager. At first, he was ridiculed for his hobby.
I had to face a lot of financial pressure, and my neighbors and even my family were against me. They'd criticize me for not farming my land like everyone else. They'd say, those stupid robots, they can't get you money and can't get you food. That was a hard time for me.
But after winning a contest a few years ago that crowned him the smartest farmer inventor in China, things began to look up. Now he's a local hero, and his wife and son work alongside him in his robot workshop. They've set up shop in the museum, building and fixing the robots on display.
I have a lot of happiness from building these robots. I feel great that I can do this. So many people talk the talk, but don't walk the walk. But I do. Whatever I can think of, I can do.
Wu's rickety robot is just one of the many inventions on display here. The show was put together by Cai Guoqiang, an international art world superstar known for his works using explosives. But the stars of this show are the 9 eccentric farmers whose machines Cai has collected over the years. Cai calls them peasant Da Vincis, and like the famous Leonardo before them, they're dreamers.
Some of them want to earn money from their inventions and develop a business. Some are curious, but some really want to win honor for China.
Made from scrap metal and found materials, their creative inventions have a do-it-yourself charm to them. Robots of all types clunk around, including one bearing a bouquet of flowers and another that clangs the cymbals. 3 robot artists produce splatter paintings Jackson Pollock style as they urge visitors to check out their works. There are even robot mice that scurry around the exhibit floor. Outside, a giant sign is painted on the museum wall, calligraphy style. Peasants make a better city, better life, it reads. It's a slogan that immediately calls to mind the other show in town, the World Expo, that modern-day world's fair that's showcasing innovations from around the globe. Again, artist Cai Guoqiang.
This World Expo's theme is better city, better life. But in my opinion, first we need to acknowledge the several hundred million peasants whose contributions have built our cities. So actually, peasants have made a better city, better life.
They are the construction workers, the cleaning ladies, and the street vendors, doing jobs no one else wants to do. Cai says they don't get the respect they deserve.
Most people in the cities, when they think of peasants, they think of dirty, messy, uncivilized. It's a way to insult someone. Of course, they forget that their parents and grandparents came from the countryside.
Karen Chun came to visit Shanghai for the World Expo and stopped in to see the art show. Usually we think of peasants as just working hard in the fields, she says. But this exhibition shows us their creativity and talent. I respect them. And that's just the kind of change in attitude that artist Cai Guoqiang had hoped the exhibit would produce. For the World Vision Report, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Ready for a poverty tour? That's right. These days, many people are taking vacations that help them understand the world better. And one of the world's biggest problems is poverty. From the slums of Mumbai to rural Maasai villages, people are paying to visit some of the world's poorest places. Josh Ruxin is the country director of the Millennium Villages Project in Rwanda, where all kinds of efforts are underway to fight poverty. In one Rwandan village, they've started offering tours. You can pay a fee to see the progress villagers have made toward a number of development goals. Josh Ruxin has toured these communities firsthand in Rwanda and in the slums of Rio de Janeiro. Now, as you know, this movement, poverty tourism, has some critics, many critics. One tourism professor we spoke with talked about this idea of visitors coming and taking pictures of the poor. It almost sounds like going to see animals in a zoo. It's a little voyeuristic, maybe. What do you say to that?
I've seen that, and I've certainly witnessed that happen all over the world, and in particular in sub-Saharan Africa. And it certainly isn't pretty. But on the other hand, I don't know that I would be so critical of people taking pictures and learning about how 3 billion people currently live in the world and going back home to their wealthy communities and showing people how they live, because I think that it can provide some level of inspiration. I mean, I think back to my roots 25 years ago in economic development, and one of my original inspirations was hearing about the famine in Ethiopia, which, talk about something voyeuristic, there were images coming back of emaciated kids who were literally dying. I was moved by the images that I saw and have tried to spend my life trying to figure out how to make a dignifying contribution to help improve the lives of the poor.
I mean, obviously it stirs people emotionally, but when they go back home, how many people or what percentage of the people do you think really do something to change the conditions for people living in slums?
Well, actually, can we just take a step back for a second? Because I actually Sure. think that those who choose to take that first step of going into a village, whether it's a Maasai village in Kenya or a village in Rwanda or the favela outside of Rio, they're actually taking a step which, in fact, can be empowering to that community depending upon how the tourism is actually set up. And if it's set up in such a way that there are members of the community who are being employed, and that people are having the opportunity to see some of the economic development opportunities that are happening there, and if they're actually spending money on tickets in order to do it, then actually by taking that action of going to visit these poor communities, they're actually helping that economic development along in a way that I actually find far more empowering than traditional aid.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Most of these tour operators are for-profit enterprises, and it's hard to lump them all into one, I know. But do you think most of the money that they're making off these tours really does trickle back into the communities that they're visiting?
I think it varies case by case, but many of the tours that I'm familiar with have 60, 70% of the total revenues actually going directly back into the community. And I would guess just off the top of my head, even if we were talking about a much smaller percentage, I think that there's a lot of good that can come of it, as long as it's the right type of stories that are coming out. So obviously, a tour literally just to go see poor, decrepit people who are suffering in the midst of a famine is not a very good idea, and it's not going to be terribly empowering. But on the other hand, I think a tour of an intact poor community, which is working on building entrepreneurialism, building up its schools, that can actually be, you know, both good lessons, but also money that flows into that community can be put to very good use and actually leave lasting improvements.
Coming up after a short break, we'll hear more from Josh Ruxin and his poverty tourism project. Stick around. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. We're back with Josh Ruxin. He's the country director of the Millennium Villages Project in Rwanda. 10 African countries have Millennium Villages. It's an attempt at a holistic approach to reducing poverty. They tackle agriculture, health, education, and infrastructure. The village is offering its own so-called poverty tour to help offset the costs of running the program. We pick up again as Josh Ruxin explains the goals of the Millennium Village and how it could help reduce poverty worldwide.
So there are donors who have donated millions of dollars over the years in order to invest in these communities. And in Rwanda, for example, we work very closely with the government. The government actually identified the site back in 2005. The site is called Mayanje. And it was really both the epicenter of the genocide and really one of the poorest places in the country when we started off there. And we started initially working on health and then eventually branched out to work with entrepreneurs and cooperatives and to work on everything from animal husbandry to improving the teacher training in the schools. And the overall goal is to demonstrate if you just do one intervention in development, you're probably not going to get a lot of traction. But if you put adequate resources into everything that's needed in order to reduce poverty, you can actually achieve great things. And in Rwanda and many other countries, we've seen those types of results.
I can really see why, as a tourist, you'd want to go. I mean, what an amazing project to see how these villages are developing and becoming self-sustaining. I'm curious as to how the people in the villages decided there in Rwanda to set up tours to have visitors in, because it didn't come from outside tour operators.
It absolutely didn't. It was far more spontaneous than I ever would have anticipated. So going back a couple of years after the project started off, very frequently the country director or I would take people out to see what was happening in Mayanje at the Millennium Village site. And after doing this for several months, community leaders actually approached our country director, who is a wonderful man named Donald Endahiro, who lives in the community. He lost his family during the genocide. He's very much integrated into the community. And they approached Donald and they said, you know, so frequently you're bringing tourists out here just to see the work that we're doing, because this is all very much a community-led initiative. We're very proud of what we're doing, and we're happy to show visitors what we're doing, but we're not sure that much is being left behind. I mean, why don't we actually charge people to see what we're doing if they're so interested in seeing it? And our reaction, slack-jawed, was, we never thought about it that way. How would you propose doing that? What they suggested was, we'll set up a community cooperative. We'll have members who will share in the proceeds of the tours. And what we're really interested in having is some training to figure out how to do this best. That was the point when I actually reached out to a tourism company that had done a little bit of community tourism in Rwanda. And I said, hey, guys, are you interested in a new site? And they were. And they found someone who was very good at working with the community to work for about 3 months' time in setting up the tour. What are the sites that are going to be visited? How do we sensitize the community about what's actually happening? How do we actually invest in the human capital in the community in order to make this a success? Eventually, the co-op grew to 350 members, so actually quite representative in this community of 25,000 people.
So how did they do it? What ended up happening?
What the community settled on was that there'd be, in general, a full-day tour. And the tour actually begins down the road from their community at a church in Niamata, which was the site of one of the worst massacres of the whole genocide, where more than 5,000 people were murdered in 1994.
Inside the church?
Yeah, inside the church and on the church grounds. There were grenades that were lobbed inside. There were only about 9 survivors out of several thousand people. So it's really a rather horrific place. And one of the reasons that the tour company and the community said it's really important for us to start here is that they wanted the tourists to understand these are our roots. This is where we were just at this point in time, 16 years ago. We want to show you, the tourist, how far we've come.
I can't imagine the tourists. How do they respond when they start the tour at this church?
Well, I mean, there aren't words for it. I mean, it's an incredibly sad, powerful, emotional place. People break down. People can't handle it.
What a way to start a tour.
Can't necessarily go into the morgue. I mean, some people actually do not enter. There are plenty of people who come to Rwanda who cannot handle seeing, for example, the skulls and the skeletons.
You go into a morgue and you see the skulls and skeletons?
Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah. Is that inside the church?
It's on the church grounds.
Oh, that would be really tough.
Very, very difficult place to go. And then moments later, people are back in their vehicles going down this beautiful new road, which was built by the government of Rwanda. And along the road, you can see new water points, you can see electrification, and new markets that are being constructed to centralize sales for the communities. So immediately, I mean, one is shocked in Rwanda by the rapidity of the development that's happening, not just in the capital, but also outside in the rural areas, too.
I'm assuming then this road takes you into the Millennium Village in Rwanda.
That's right.
I feel like I'm on the tour with you now, Josh. Don't stop here. I've just been to the church. I'm seeing all these developments. Now take me to the village and give me a picture of what I'm going to do there, if you would.
So one of the first stops is often the health center, because the health center tends to be extremely busy in the morning. And this is a health center which, when we actually started working in the community, was literally shuttered. I mean, the doors of it were closed. And I remember the first time that I went there, there were people literally dying from malaria on the steps. Today, on this tour, people will go to a health center where the doors haven't actually been shut since the project started, where actually the project doesn't even have to engage anymore because it's a fully sustainable, ongoing, government-run health center. There's over a dozen nurses. And in general, what they'll see that they wouldn't have seen, say, 5 or 6 years ago, is a relatively healthy population of people.
Okay, so now I've been to the church, I've gone down the road, I've seen the development projects, I stop at the clinic, I see all the advances in healthcare. Then where do I go?
So what happens when you've got healthy people? Well, healthy people, of course, are more productive people. So you'll head out and go visit some farming families out in their fields and see what they're growing.
What do the tourists at the end of the day say? Are their views of Rwanda really changed, or do they go back with any new ideas?
The majority of people, and I actually know this firsthand because whenever my family comes over to visit, I don't take them out any longer. I send them on the tour. And the experience of family members that I've had that have gone is, you know, we've had amazing wildlife experiences in Africa, and we really love being in Africa, and we really enjoy it. But the place that we learn the most and the place that we're most moved to actually see development in progress and to actually hear the stories is out in Mayanje.
Do you see this kind of community tourism, which some call poverty tourism, as a growing industry, whether it's millennium villages in Rwanda or slums in Kibera?
Absolutely. I think that people are longing for something more than Club Med and Disney World, and to have the opportunity to see how billions of people on planet Earth are living and see what their challenges are and see what those opportunities look like, that's something that people are interested in. If you just take a look at what people are reading these days, I mean, Nick Kristof's new book called Half the Sky about maternal death and sexual slavery around the world, all these issues, people are interested in finding out what does poverty look like and what are the opportunities for doing something about it. And that is where I think this community tourism comes in, which is that by actually doing a community tour, which is well organized and where the funds are actually going for local wages and to invest in the community, there's an opportunity to make an improvement by doing tourism. I mean, how often can you say that? I guess you might be making an improvement in the American economy if you go to Disney World because you're helping with local employment. So why not go to Mayanje, Rwanda to help with local employment there and conduct tourism over there?
Josh Ruxin is director of the Millennium Villages Project in Rwanda. Josh, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
When we travel to a foreign country, we tend to bring along our own cultural biases. That's what reporter Gina Moore did when she took a trip to the capital of the Central African Republic. Gina filed this reporter's notebook about a brief encounter that made her think twice about her assumptions.
There was a man selling Cokes from a red cooler outside the World Health Organization headquarters. Bangui is impressively poor, even by African standards. About two-thirds of its residents survive on less than a dollar a day. So the 500 francs, or roughly $1, that I shelled out to chug a soda beneath a beach umbrella was all the money the man who sold it would earn that day, statistically speaking. As I gulped, something caught my eye. On a stool behind the cooler, beneath a bag of small change, I saw sheet music, penned by hand. "You're a musician?" I asked. "No, a composer," he said, handing me the page. He had about 25 bars worth of a church song. The flirtatious flags of eighth notes, the thick hips of the whole notes, and the even, fine-line musical staff. Everything had been delicately inscribed on the page. "It's too bad I don't have my violin," I offered. "I could play your music and you could sing the words." At first he looked surprised, as if I had suggested I sing the words in Sango, the local language. And then he seemed to pity me. I admire your gumption, his face seemed to say. A for effort. Can you read music? He asked me. I wanted to shout, well, of course I can, but I was stunned to be on the other end of the stereotype, and I could only nod. He smiled and then declared, that is impressive. The whole thing reminded me of someone I'd met 2 years earlier when I was reporting with a friend in Kinshasa. We'd handed off our laundry at the hotel, and a tall young man gave us back our clothing, pressed and perfectly folded. You look like my music teacher, he told my friend. This is not what we'd expected to hear from the guy who ironed our trousers. But our laundryman was an oboist in the Kinshasa Symphony Orchestra. They practiced every week, Tuesdays if I remember correctly. I told him I play the violin, and he said it's too bad we didn't meet until Wednesday morning. His genuine sympathy for my bad timing will always make me wonder if there's some secret to playing Beethoven I could only have learned in Congo. This is not the Africa we see on the news. That's probably not going to change. I doubt that I'm going to get a story published about the Bangui composer who sells cokes on the road. But what might change is what we look for. Why shouldn't one of the biggest cities in the world have a symphony orchestra? And why shouldn't I think to ask if it does?
Gina Moore is a freelance journalist based in Rwanda. Her story was funded by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Now we head to Jamaica, famous for white sandy beaches and reggae. We're stopping at a roadside grill in Montego Bay. It's a mom-and-pop restaurant built out of an old metal shipping container. Winnie Allen is mom. She's been cooking for her regulars for decades. And one of her most frequent orders is ackee and saltfish. Ever heard of it? Well, we're told ackee is a fruit that looks like a small pomegranate. Saltfish is dried cod. Chop them up and fry them and, well, reporter Judith Ritter and Mom will give us a taste in this installment of our What's Cooking series.
Thank you for inviting me to the kitchen.
It's a pleasure. I'm going to do ackee and saltfish, which is our national dish.
That sounds great. I love ackee. I think it's pretty high in cholesterol, but...
Never mind. This is a saltfish. This is the ackee. Okay, I'm getting the ackee together. Just pour it in like this.
Now, the ackee looks like little pieces of yellow fruit.
Some people say it looked like scrambled egg.
Somebody told me that ackee is poisonous on the tree.
When it is not properly open on the tree, it could be poisonous because there's a certain gas that is in there. So, therefore, you have to let it open properly.
Is it a favorite of yours?
Very. I love it. Well, we always have this for breakfast, especially on a Sunday morning. Mm. And a cup of chocolate, Jamaican chocolate, the one that you buy in the market, and you grate it. And you boil it with cinnamon and the coconut cream.
Now, what you're doing here...
I'm getting the saltfish together. Now I'm going to get my onions. And I'm going to get my tomatoes, nice red tomatoes. And this is my oil here. Pour some oil in this.
So you just poured the oil in. Next step?
Next step is I put my tomatoes. And this is onion, garlic, pepper, tomatoes. Okay. And then I'm going to put the saltfish in. Just pour it in like this.
So that's little pieces of...
saltfish.
Yeah, cod?
Cod, you call it codfish. We call it saltfish.
What would it cost for somebody to make a dish like that for themselves at home?
Not expensive. A couple of pieces of saltfish. And most people grow ackee here. Most people have an ackee tree.
So that makes it less expensive.
Mm-hmm. Get some black pepper. Then I get a little black pepper.
Sprinkle it.
Right, over it. And then it's ready.
Really? You're just mixing?
That's all it takes. No time. And this snow is normally served like with roast breadfruit and the rice and peas or some sweet potato.
So you just mix it up?
Just like that. It's ready for serving now. And beside it is dumpling and yam and some stir-fried vegetables. Avocado and your gungu rice and peas over there.
There's a song about Aki.
Very popular song in Jamaica. This lady took her Aki to the market, and it was a very bad night. She didn't sell all her Aki, so she was just there singing.
So what did she sing?
Me Aki girl instead market, not a quarter would sell. Carry me Aki girl instead market, not a quarter would sell. Lord, what a night, what a night, what a Saturday night. Lord, what a night, what a night, what a Saturday night.
Okay, I'm going to try this. Here we go. I'm going to try the Aki first. It's just perfect. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and nice to have me. Me Aki girl instead market, not a quarter would sell. Carry me Aki girl instead market, not a quarter would sell. Lord, what a night, what a night, what a Saturday night. Lord, what a night, what a night, what a Saturday night.
That was reporter Judith Ritter in Montego Bay, Jamaica. If you want to see pictures of Winnie and her ackee and saltfish, we've got some at our website, worldvisionreport.org.
Get you coconut water. Man, it's good for your daughter. Cocoa got a lot of iron. Make you strong like a lion.
Coming up, we head to Yemen. Precious water there is feeding the country's drug habit.
I can't consider life without God. It's essential. Even some families chew it together. But usually it's men who gather together and chew in what is called God sessions.
Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Now we're off to the Arabian Peninsula, to Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. You'll see lots of men there sitting around chewing a narcotic plant called khat. But that habit is making the desert city run dry. In fact, experts say Sana'a is literally running out of water because they're using so much of it to grow the addictive plant. Almost all the men in Yemen chew khat. It produces a mild high, and the farms that grow it are siphoning off a big chunk of Sana'a's water supply. That, coupled with Sana'a's exploding population, means that the city is emptying out its water basin at a staggering rate. About four times as much water is taken out as falls into it each year. Dale Gavlak reports from Sana'a.
It's a steady flow of traffic on Street 45 just before noon. Cars jam the lanes, while eager customers, mainly Yemeni men, crowd the stalls to buy their daily fix of khat, or ghat, as some here pronounce it. The leafy green plant produces a mild high when chewed. It's all legal, and the nation is hooked. The customers here, wearing long robes and belts, holding a traditional golden dagger at the waist, explain.
I can't consider life without ghat. It's essential. Even some families chew it together. But usually it's men who gather together and chew in what is called ghat sessions.
We have a sacred tradition in Yemen that we chew ghat after lunch and into the evening. It's frankly more important than food.
I will chew the ghat all the day. It's better than I get drink and do something forbidden in our religion. So it's the situation in our country, and the situation control us.
Most of the men I spoke with in this market realize that their addiction is quickly robbing Yemen of its scarce water supplies. It's widely known that the plant takes an excessive amount of water to grow, especially in a desert region. Salim Abdullah is a vendor here.
Using ghat is more important than the water crisis for people because they're accustomed to having it every day. The most important thing is that ghat is available in the market when people need it.
But what seems to elude both caught traders and customers is if water supplies do indeed run out, so will the ability to grow and sell their precious ghat. When I point that out, they simply shrug. Later in the day, I pass men on Sana'a streets, their cheeks bulging with a tennis ball size of accumulated chewed ghat leaves. I head to a water expert to get some perspective. Even the taxicab driver insists on chewing ghat as he drives. And along the way, I pass a sign of just how bad the water crisis is here. It's a water pumping station with tankers lined up to be filled with water for distribution in richer districts in the city. Sakhar Al-Aywi is one of the tanker drivers. I load up about 7 times a day to make the rounds, he says. The price of water varies day to day, but people can pay the equivalent of up to $9 for 500 gallons of water. Poor neighborhoods may share the expense of a tanker's worth of water. Cheaper water is piped into homes here, but just once a week. Without these extra and costly deliveries, most families would run out. Water expert Anwar Sohuli tells me that at the current rate of water consumption for ghat, Sana'a will run dry in about 7 years. That's because the city, like the rest of Yemen, is solely dependent on underground aquifers.
There is rainfall, but unfortunately, most of the rain is not caught or does not replenish the underground water aquifers. We are now drawing water which has been accumulating for tens of thousands of years. So this is, in my opinion, is irreplaceable. It cannot be recharged naturally or even, in my opinion, artificially.
So Huli says drastic measures are needed to avert a water crisis. But as for the idea that people should grow and chew less ghat, well, Sohuli recently wrote a newspaper article saying just that. After it appeared, he says he got threats, but refused to say what kind. Salim Beshawab chairs the National Water Resources Authority and says the Yemeni government plans to encourage the importation of ghat.
Ghat in surrounding countries is very cheap and it's a very good quality. So if you import it here, people will go and take the cheaper and the good quality one.
Beshawab hopes that once that happens, ghat farmers will get the message.
So they will think of growing other things, maybe coffee or other crop which could give them more income. Yeah.
Beshawab says the government is brainstorming about how to help the farmers do just that. But it will take a lot of convincing for farmer Ahmed Anous to change his livelihood. Sitting near an overflowing irrigation pipe, he says that he sells more than $200 worth of ghat each day and makes a hefty profit. And he adds it doesn't require much work. If other ghat farmers here feel the same way, the Yemeni government may find itself fighting an uphill battle to save the country's water. For the World Vision Report, I'm Dale Gavlak in Sana'a, Yemen.
And now we'll hear from our global guru. She's taking us to hear some extremely rare Cambodian music.
Welcome to the Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. This week we ask one simple question, just one, from somewhere in the world. Today we're in Cambodia asking, what is a mem?
1,000 years ago, these instruments play everywhere in Cambodia.
This is Arn Chorn Pond, founder of Cambodia Living Arts. Their mission is to find the master artist who survived Cambodia's 1975 to 1979 genocide. Dancers, musicians, visual artists, CLA has found many and pays them to teach the next generation. But the mem, well, Pont had never even heard of the instrument, let alone seen anyone play it.
We've heard through word by mouth about the instruments, but then, you know, we went visit with the School of Fine Art, also with the government officials, that this instrument still exists. We don't know where.
So he went to Angkor Wat, the famous temple complex in Cambodia, and he saw the mem carved into the ancient walls. It looked a little like a one-stringed guitar, with a second string going from the body of the instrument into the musician's mouth.
They have a snake skin, maybe covered the wood one side, and then they have the string. They have their fingers on it as a fret, you know. But there's no fret. And then there's another string in the end of it with the lizard scale, you know, lizard scale in their mouth, and their mouth move around, open and close.
The body of the mem and the musician's mouth together create the sound. It might be one of the strangest instruments in existence.
It sounds primitive, but the way they're playing it, it's haunted somehow.
Pan set out to see if anyone today could play it. He worked with the Ministry of Culture for months. And then one day, in the far northern province of Ratnakari on the Vietnam-Lao border,
Pan Dao,
the last remaining mem player in the world.
For sounds a little bit like flute, a little bit like a fiddle, you know, but very, very unique. Very few notes they are playing, but it's difficult to grasp it, you know, difficult to understand it.
Pan brought him to Phnom Penh, where he trained a handful of young people to play. But he taught only a few years before he was killed in a road accident. Today, fewer than a dozen people play the mem. But Pond is grateful that he never gave up the search.
The mums, you know, like finding a unicorn, you know?
You hear it, he says, and it pulls your heart away.
That was our global guru, Rachel Louise Snyder. For video of this haunting music, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. We all know how easy it is to take things you've grown up around for granted. Maybe that's part of the reason why we like to travel, to see where we live with new eyes. But imagine growing up in the midst of nearly millennium-old historical monuments and not knowing their history. That was the case for many young people living in a neighborhood of Delhi, India. That is, until a nonprofit organization stepped in to teach them how to be tour guides. The training is part of a larger project to restore not just the dilapidated monuments and gardens of the past, but the living culture of the local community. Sunita Thakur reports.
A group of about 30 school kids gather around 19-year-old Mohammed Umar in the courtyard of a mosque. They're here to see a famous 21-foot-high iron pillar called the Qutub Minar, that has mysteriously remained rust-free for more than 2,000 years. One young boy wants to know why there's only one iron pillar and not four, as his grandmother had told him there should have been. Muhammad tells them that in fact there are two ancient iron pillars in Delhi, but the most impressive one is here at the Qutub Minar. Muhammad, along with 10 other young men, are newly trained tour guides from the historically renowned Muslim quarter of Delhi, known as the Nizamuddin Basti. They're part of a program known as the Heritage Walk Project, and this is just a dress rehearsal of sorts. The tour walks don't actually begin until November. Although, if the guides can handle this audience, adults should be no problem. The project is run by the Aga Khan Trust for Culture. Ratish Nanda is the director.
Now, the Heritage Walk program is quite interesting because what it does is not only does it provide employment to a lot of energetic youth from the area, you see that municipalities get involved, ensure cleanliness, local people start taking pride in their own heritage, which is the only sustainable way to preserve this heritage for the future generations.
The guides, some in their final year of high school, others already in college, were chosen based on economic need and academic achievement. The program would have accepted girls, but their families weren't willing to let them travel outside their neighborhood to attend classes in English and the history of the numerous tombs, monuments, and mosques in the Nizamuddin Basti.
We are going to earn and learn.
Mohammed says he's looking forward to starting the job, which, depending on the number of tours they do, pays about $50 a month.
I didn't know anything about the history of this neighborhood or how old the monuments were until I started working here. It's only since the course that I've realized all of this. So now I'm very proud when I tell others about this place.
I took a tour around the Nizamuddin Basti with 20-year-old Amir Ahmed, who wants to be an architect.
So first here you see, this is a gateway of the Basti, an enclosure wall of the Basti.
Amir stands in front of an archway covered with a profusion of green, which leads into the Basti.
This street we call Flower Street.
The neighborhood, or Basti as it's known in Urdu, is named after the revered Sufi saint Hazrat Nizamuddin, who died and was buried here in the 14th century. In Islamic culture, to be buried near a saint is auspicious, so royalty, poets, and artists have chosen this area as their final resting place. Over the centuries, a vibrant community and culture was born. Most outsiders don't go beyond the Nizamuddin tomb, which attracts thousands of pilgrims, and have no idea of the warren of medieval streets, old houses, and mosques that make this Basti one of the most important historical sites in India.
Okay, now here you can see this is a Kalan Mosque. Kalan means big. And this mosque has more than 200 pillars and more than 50 domes. And more than 300 people are praying together here.
This area is 700 years old, so it is great for me to get to interact with tourists that will come here. One always learns from new people. Also, if tourists get a chance to come to Nizamuddin, local businesses will grow and our culture will become better known. So basically, we will benefit with this program.
The young men seem to have formed a tight-knit group, even contributing to a common kitty for any emergencies. Again, Amir Ahmed.
The Aga Khan Foundation will go away sooner or later, but the closeness and unity we have discovered, this shouldn't break.
Meanwhile, back at Delhi's famous Iron Pillar, the heat doesn't stop the young kids from having the time of their lives, and, if they're to be believed, aspiring to be future tour guides.
Yes, I want to do this work.
You want to do this?
Yes, yes, ma'am.
Why?
Because there is very interest. And if we know the knowledge, when we grow up, then we can tell everybody that this something.
For the World Vision Report, this is Sunita Thakur in New Delhi, India.
This is Qawwali music, which is devotional music from the Sufi branch of Islam. This piece was sung in the neighborhood we just toured by Gaus Muhammad Nasser and his group. Every Thursday evening, Sufi music is played in the courtyard where the Sufi saint Hazrat Nizamuddin is buried. Sunita tells us that as many Hindus as Muslims gather to listen to it. And now our trip is winding down. But before it's over, we take you to a sunset market in Nigeria, where some very ornery-sounding camels are up for sale.
It's sunset at the Camel and Livestock Market on the outskirts of Maiduguri, a remote city in the far northeast of Nigeria. Cattle tethered in pens made from tree branches stand mournfully to one side. The old men selling them sit in groups, chatting, or playing handcrafted board games. In a corner, bleating herds of sheep jostle together, all big eyes and long legs. But it's the camels that command the most attention. Young men haul them before prospective buyers, pulling with all their might on the rope fastened to the camel's lower jaw. Particularly stubborn ones are whipped energetically. The camels howl and growl in protest. The camels are not cheap. about $100 and more. So it's essential to haggle fiercely. When a price is agreed, the buyer's number is painted on the camel's neck, and the complaining beast is slowly and reluctantly dragged off. Many of the men at the market are from far beyond Nigeria's northern borders, desert people who live a nomadic life and wear turbans and flowing robes. Amid all this, motorbikes zip through the crowds and feeding animals, taking a shortcut home. Young boys and girls sell sweets, snacks, and sunglasses. Many of them rattle two pieces of metal together or have a bell to attract the attention of potential buyers. A man at the back of the market has a large goods stall, kitted out with a reedy stereo, blasting music popular in this part of northern Nigeria. The camels may be the main attraction, but not the only one at this bustling marketplace.
That audio postcard came from freelance journalist Sarah Simpson. And that's it for our Getaway Vacation special this week. Remember, you can hear the show anytime on our website, worldvisionreport.org. The program was produced by Susan Shepherd and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is our assignment editor. Christina Darden and Cynthia Graber produce our interviews. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the organization.